The Football Show on Off the Ball.
With Sky. Watch big games from the Women's Super League live on Sky Sports.
I'm prepared to anything I can
well,
to play
it then.
Country again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should there be an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
You're welcome along to the football show. Later on, we will be hearing from Saoirse Noonan, who is doing great things at Shelburne and increasingly the Republic of Ireland as well. First, Miguel Delaney of the London Independent is on the line. Evening, Miguel.
Hi, Joe.
A few things to throw at you. So over here, we're all very invested in Ireland's dead rubber matches and the future under Stephen Kenny, bright or otherwise, depending on your persuasion. Meanwhile, for others, i.e. England, this time of the year when it comes to international football is just all too boring. And Michael Owen crystallised this sense more than most. He tweeted after England's whipping of San Marino, rapidly falling out of love with watching international football, barring the big tournaments. I think a lot of people feel the same way. Half of these games are absolutely pointless. Restructure is needed. I was thinking, geez, we've come a long way since Graham Taylor and come a long way since missing out in USA 94. It's just too easy for England now, frankly. I wouldn't think Michael Owen, by the way, is alone in thinking this over in England.
No, I think you're right. And I suppose that is a problem, to be fair, from viewing international football purely through the prism of English international matches, because they have, I mean, they've almost been Germany-like late in the last few campaigns in terms of just motoring through qualification. The one thing I would say, I was at the game last night, and my view would generally be that there shouldn't be pre-qualifying, that we should allow the minnows in, it fits with the democracy of football. And then I attended a game like that last night, and it just wasn't a football match. So I do actually have, well, I think Owen went way too far. He's wrong about half the matches, and you only have to look across Europe and other games last night and over the last few days to see the contrast. But talking about these games with minnows are a different thing. And I do think there is a legitimate argument where it comes to the idea of pre-qualifying. Because it must be said, actually, Europe's a little bit out of kilter there, because almost every single national federation has nearly every single continental federation actually has pre-qualifying, bar Europe and South America. Although even South America doesn't have kind of the three smaller nations like Guyana in that degree. So I think there's a bigger debate than what Owen said, because I mean watching it last night, it was a freak show of a game. And I know one of the arguments is always, it's a great honor for these players, and you know, it really means everything, it really means the world for like the players of Andorra or San Marino to play. But that shouldn't be a guidance for how international football should be run. It's an honor for a few people. It should be about what's good for the sport. Because this is a point actually David Wilson made, the former Gibraltar manager, that we're not actually seeing development of some of these smaller countries. Now, certainly not in these games, but we do see development in something like the Nations League, which pits more of them together. And it was something the San Marino manager actually said after the game last night. So I do think there is a legitimate argument made to that. Because, I mean, one thing that struck me last night was more than anything, more than even the scoreline, was the physical difference between the English players and the San Marino players. It was like just two completely different levels of sport, I mean, to a really, really pronounced degree. It was much worse, say, than Marine against Tottenham Hotspur in the FA Cup in January. Now, that was the biggest ever gap between FA Cup sides in the history of the competition. There was 161 places between them, and this was way worse. There was one moment in the game where Saka gave the guy that was marking him a 2-yard head start, and like within milliseconds he was already way ahead of him. There was just no comparison between teams. And it does, just because I went to that game last night, at least when you go to an FA Cup game like that, there's a sense of jeopardy or a sense of a potential upset. There was none of that last night. It just wasn't a football match.
Yeah, it was 10-0 for anyone who missed it, by the way. Even Roy Keane, I think, afterwards on ITV was saying, well, they shouldn't be on the same pitch, really. Harry Kane scored 4. Emil Smith-Rowe started alongside him with Phil Foden as a front three. They had Saka, as you mentioned, as one wing back. Trent Alexander-Arnold the other. Calvin Phillips, Jude Bellingham in midfield. Back three of Mings, who scored. Connor Cody was there. Harry Maguire, who also scored, Emile Smith-Rowe scored, Bukayo Saka did, and Tammy Abraham did as well. I don't know what the solution is. You're verging on European Super League territory here, Miguel.
I completely disagree with that line of argument, I have to say. Because the Super League was such a specific thing and really about creating a cartel.
Yeah.
It just isn't that.
Yeah.
And also, you're not limiting the passage up either. It would just be about, I mean, because it's also about developing the game at that level. But at the moment, the mismatch is so profound. It's just, it's incomparable to the arguments about the Super League. And also, the fundamental idea would be, to give these smaller nations regular games where they can develop. And also, I mean, one potential idea I would say is that while, say, the World Cup qualification is running, you could have one or two qualified minnows in it, and at the same time run, say, a European pre-qualifying for those minnows that aren't in it. And then, you know, the two who come up from that get into the next stage of qualifying. I would actually strongly disagree with the kind of Super League arguments. I think they're two very different things.
So England played 10 in this group. They won 8. They drew 2. The 2 draws away to Poland and at home to Hungary. So they have cruised home in fairly routine fashion. And they do make it very routine now. I mean, the talent is never ending. I mean, I mentioned Smith-Rowe coming through and Saka doing very well. And there is just one after the other at the moment. Jude Bellingham played. Probably difficult to read too much into any of the performances against that opposition, I would think.
Oh, yeah, completely. I mean, that was the thing about covering the game last night as well. I mean, it was barely worth even registering the nature of the goals because it was just a complete circus of a match. the one thing I would say, actually, is that I think this is something that could end up counting against England. And while I know there's a lot of debate over Selke. I think broadly he's done a good job. He's got a lot of the elements of it right. I think there's still remaining questions over he's a step behind the top international managers because obviously international football is behind the club game. And he's not at the moment, he's not up there with Mancini. Not Mancini's problems with Italy right now, notwithstanding. He's not up there with Luis Enrique. And my fear for England now at the moment, so maybe a lot of Irish people wouldn't call it a fear, they've got this supreme generation of players, as you say, like just so much talent coming through. But it almost, it sometimes feels like Soke, he's actually trying too many different things. It's all too wide. Where, say, look what's happening suddenly with Spain. I know Spain have been a little bit uncertain through this qualification campaign, but suddenly there's a good core of players and they're all being brought into an ideology that's quite set. Everyone knows what they have to do. And I think that does allow them to reach a higher ceiling, which could be seen, say, even in the game they went out in Euro 2020, the semi-final against Italy, that they only lost on penalties. Really should have won that game, to be honest. Mm. Whereas England always feels like the squad are playing within themselves a bit. It's almost like having a structure imposed on a team rather than them being integrated into the structure. Would that bring more out of them, if you know what I mean?
No, I do totally. And that's maybe a continuation of a trend, because I think with Southgate, realistically, he might try different things and have tried different things here in qualifying. And once he gets to Qatar and is playing tournament football, we know what his approach is to tournament football. There's a very conservative slant to his approach. I'd be surprised if that suddenly changes come the next World Cup. We'll see how far that gets them. I suspect, though, he may be dealing with questions along the lines of, well, if you had just taken the shackles off a touch, we could have done more in this tournament if they don't go on to win it. Like, it would be really interesting if Southgate was suddenly on the market for whatever reason, where in the Premier League food chain he might pitch up.
Well, this is it. I mean, I have to say, it's an interesting one. In England, actually, around these two games, one of the big storylines has been over Southgate's new contract, which I do find not curious, but I don't think there's that much competition for him. And like with the way these things come out, there's been all sorts of conversations about where it's actually coming from, whether someone's trying to kind of what's the angle here. But ultimately, I don't think that the FA would have too much competition for signature. Of the big six sides, the only ones I could see actually going for him are if they were to sack Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, Manchester United, because it would seem like precisely the sort of with the greatest will in the world, the way the club is run right now, exactly the sort of kind of almost superficial decision. Maybe superficial is the wrong word, but just kind of going off almost the profile of Southgate rather than what he actually is as a manager and whether he would be suited to club management in the same degree. Because, again, as I say, well, I think he's got a lot of qualities, and particularly qualities suited to being an international figurehead. I would doubt whether he's anywhere near the level of a Klopp or a Tuchel or a Conte or a Guardiola, which is, of course, I think what the big six should be going for.
Mm. Harry Maguire scored again, back-to-back games, so he's on 7 goals for England now. This makes him England's highest ever scoring defender. Pips, Jack Charlton and John Terry, they're on 6. Maguire's on 7 and 41 goals. I didn't see the game again. I take it he didn't cup his hands behind his ears this time, or did he?
No, instead this time he did a kind of a shushing gesture, which, to be fair, I think was a lot more kind of ironic or sardonic, should we say, than Friday. There's a bit more fun to it than Friday.
Okay. Well, I'm kind of glad to hear that because, you know, Gabby Agbon-Lahore accused Roy Keane effectively of bullying Harry Maguire at this stage. And like Keane went for him after the cupped ears celebration first came around. And I was thinking to myself, God, I wonder how Maguire is coping with all this focus. And, you know, like every gesture now being analysed and in some situations impersonated on television. So it's good to see there's a sense of irony and humour there left.
Yeah, and to be like, I'd have a little bit of sympathy for Maguire there because he's in a bit of a difficult position. Now, like, he obviously gets so much criticism now. I mean, I don't think he's an absolutely top class centre half. He probably wasn't worth that money, but he's still a good centre half. And I think he's proven that with certain performances over the last few years, and particularly for England. And I think one of the reasons he's looked so bad this season is because the wider context of United. It's not actually about Harry Maguire, it's more about what Manchester United are. And I do find Keane's commentary in that regard quite interesting and maybe a little bit instructive, because obviously Keane is very close to Solskjaer, and like Solskjaer has brought him in to talk to the team, and I think it's known that they actually speak a little bit. And I often wonder is Keane almost venting frustrations on behalf of his friend in that regard? Not that Solskjaer is telling him to criticize these players or anything like that, but it's more so that Keane, because I don't want to say he's got a blind spot to Solskjaer, but he's another former teammate who hasn't exactly kind of criticised him on the media. And in that regard, it's always easier to kind of go on to the players. And when Maguire's the captain, and again, it's another difficult one for Maguire, because obviously the archetype of a Manchester United captain, probably even beyond Brian Robson at this point, is Roy Keane.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing Keane's stock at the moment. He's almost like the voice in English football. At the moment, I mean, him and Neville, maybe, I guess, and Carragher. But even the fact that ITV, when they're setting out their stall for England international matches, are saying, yeah, we'll take the bloke from Ireland because, well, he's essential here.
Yeah. Now, it actually felt like Southgate was asked about Keane on Maguire the other day. And it felt like, I'm not sure we'd call it a dig, but it was almost, the implication was almost that it's clickbait commentary almost, that it's all basically lines that and I suppose this is one of the great appeals for any broadcaster that has Keane. He's so acerbic, he's very witty, Keane. I mean, it sometimes feels like he'd be a better actor than a speaker than anything else, because he's very funny. But the way he speaks is obviously completely suited to 30-second clips he can throw up on social media.
I'd miss that on Southgate's part. I guess we're also immersed in Stephen Kenny world over here and the Irish situation over here. So did Southgate use the phrase clickbait?
No, he didn't say clickbait specifically, but that was one of the readings I took from it, shall we say.
Okay, interesting. Harry Kane, he is scoring goals for England, so he has suddenly hit 48 goals, back-to-back hat-tricks for the other night. He scored 16 international goals in 2021. That's the most any player's netted for England in a single calendar year, which is very interesting. And like 48's a big number, like Lineker stuck in 48. Bobby Charlton for so long, 49 was the number until Wayne Rooney came along. So you'd kind of back Kane to break the record now. What do you make of this dichotomy between his English form and his Spurs form? What does that tell us about Kane or international football? I don't know which.
I think it ultimately says international football, well, certainly qualification isn't anywhere near as high as what he's doing in the Premier League. He hasn't looked himself in the Premier League. Now, Conte's come in at Spurs and he has general questions about the fitness of the team. And we can only include Kane in that because he hasn't looked himself, either physically or even psychologically. He's not running the same, and it doesn't feel like he has the same kind of swagger. But obviously that changes then when he plays for England, and particularly when he plays for England against opposition like last night or Albania. And now I think it's possible that's what he needs. Kane has always been a bit of a slow start at the season, particularly when he's coming back off injuries. So he maybe just needs a few games like this. And it's possible that Antonio Conte was actually might have been delighted that he was playing last night. In fact, you can fairly conclude that the decision to play Kane last night would have been taken in full consultation with Conte, because obviously they want to keep him sharp. But I don't think these goals really say too much about Harry Kane at all. Mm. Beyond that, there is the possibility they might restore him to something like the Kane we know well, because he's still only got one goal in the Premier League this season, which is highly unusual for him. And four against San Marino is not going to change that other than maybe boosting his confidence. But yeah, it's amazing how hungry he is for goals. I mean, Southgate made no secret of this before the game, that Kane was basically almost pressurising him or on him all the time to let him play against San Marino, because he hadn't started any of the other three games so far against San Marino at home or Andorra home or away.
Mm. Just one last question on England before I ask you about your piece on Qatar in the London Independent today. You would have grown up watching football when relations between press and team were not good and the tabloids went for England, and, you know, it's all very storied. I mentioned Graham Taylor earlier in the conversation, and that continued long after he had stepped down or he was fired as English manager. And Southgate made a real concerted effort to improve relations, and we've seen that at major tournaments. What's it like covering England now, and not least in this kind of qualifying period, because everybody knows England are going to qualify. Michael Owen finds the whole thing a bit tiresome and pointless, and I can understand that. So is it cordial and friendly and players are happy to stop and chat, or is maybe there a suspicion that the press at all times are just looking to stir it up, and if they can take Roy Keane and get Gareth Southgate to say clickbait, then they're going to jump at it, and so there's a standoffishness. How are relations between press and Team England in between tournaments?
Quite good, I have to say. It's something, to be fair, the FA were very conscious of. They made a concerted effort, and I think they also realise, and this isn't just about them and the press, it's also because international teams, because everything we've just been saying, really, international teams have to fight for their space now amongst just how much the club game dominates. And I was even thinking about this the other day when I was talking to someone about kind of Nike. And if you remember, like 10 years ago, Brazil used to be the marquee brand for Nike. So much of Nike in football was based around Brazil. And that just doesn't hold the same sway now. And that's not just because of how Brazil has changed. So the FA have realised that. So when we go to camps, they really do, like these days, when you deal with most of the big clubs, with some exceptions, it's actually very difficult to get interviews. And part of that, many of us suspect, is basically because clubs don't just see themselves as football clubs anymore. They're content providers. Sure. And it's almost like their media teams are competing with us for FaceTime with players. And you can even see it in the way club websites will actually put up that they have an exclusive interview with one of their own players. Whereas the FA will basically, every camp, they'll put up a series of players. So they're very conscious of putting that image across. Also, I think you can probably see this in kind of, I suppose, like you referenced there, documentaries like the Graham Taylor Impossible Job one. The profile of the press pack has changed. From my perception, and from what some of the lads in the press pack here would say, having previous experience, I think it's much less, how to put this diplomatically, it's much less...
Oh, I'm looking forward to this adjective. This is going to be good.
Maybe there's fewer perceived alpha males in the pack.
Okay.
No, but I think it's just generally it's a less aggressive pack, in the sense of just kind of, you know, looking for a headline, no matter what it be, beyond anything else.
Right.
And I think there's better relations. I think the journalism is, I should stress, is as good as ever, if not better than ever. But just, I suppose, the relationship is different in that regard. It's the dynamic is different, and generally it's more favourable, or not. It's more cordial, at least, between the England camp and the media. But of course, the one massive caveat there is, of course, things are always more cordial when results are going well. That's true of everything.
Well, I think those sensibilities in the press have softened across the board. Like, it's now not a done thing anymore that you can call for a manager's head on Sky Sports, seemingly. I mean, you can say everything but, and you can effectively say, I think this manager's no good and they should get a better manager, but I'm not saying he should be sacked. You know, they've reached that level of, well, there's just a red line.
Which is remarkable, really, because, I mean, a football manager getting sacked at the elite level, it's just not comparable to someone else losing their job.
Yeah.
And it's such a stable... I had a little bit... So during the United-Liverpool game, I think I tweeted something like, this should be a sacking performance. And I think I stand by that. It should be. It should have been a game that cost an elite manager in elite sport... Sorry, a manager in elite sport to lose his job. Because those are the levels we're talking about. And Phil Neville quote tweeted me and said, do you feel happy saying this? Well, yes, I do. Because if someone like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer loses his job... It's not in the context of the man on the street losing his job. He's still, and this is elite sport. And you're right, because as you say, on all these sort of shows, they will basically say everything about a manager, talk about why he's not good enough for the job. And what right, and even though the logical conclusion of all of this is basically that they should replace him, it's as if it's kind of somehow sacrosanct that you can't go beyond that line. But it's the obvious logical implication.
I know. I sometimes feel sorry for Kelly Cates or Dave Jones when that is the logical conclusion, but they can't just push the button on it and be done with it. And so the conversation almost revolves again, back around to everybody again. On Qatar, football can cause real change in Qatar by calling for investigations into debts and demanding compensation. A very interesting piece today on the London Independent site for people if they want to check it out. And you're just, I guess, noting where we are. At this point now, so many countries are talking about going to Qatar, and it's just a commonplace, very normal expression for players and managers to say. And I guess your point is that is the point. That was part of Qatar's thinking. And there was one, the corrupt nature of the bid. And then two, across the last 10 years, there's been the many, many unexplained deaths amongst construction workers. And we're seeing the deplorable conditions in which they've had to work. And very little has improved. And you quote, for instance, United Nations report saying that the improvements in, or it's an amnesty report, excuse me, the labour reforms have stagnated. And that report came out, you know, just in the last week or two. So you stop and think about that for a second, that the reforms have stagnated as we hurtle towards the World Cup here. So in effect, the whole thing has been, from start to finish, basically, because we're nearly at the finish, horrific. You know, not enough has improved along the way. And I guess you're wondering in your piece, what is the appropriate response of players and managers here? What can we expect of them? And what is fair to expect of them? And that's always been the dilemma to some extent or other. So where are we on that?
Well, that's as the England squad discussed this week, they're qualified, because the line throughout qualification, and I didn't quite agree with this because they can make a stand anyway, was that it would be inappropriate to talk about Qatar without having yet qualified. But obviously, I mean, my point of view is that it shouldn't matter whether you qualify or not. Whether you qualify or not, this is a bigger issue.
Yeah.
But they've qualified now, and they said they will. Southgate talked about it a little bit last night. He equivocated in a way he can do sometimes these issues. And Conor Cody, he said before the game that the players will sit down and have a big discussion about it. And I think that's where we're at, a very interesting point. The players obviously feel the need to do something, and to be fair, it would be in keeping with a lot of activism that the players, to their immense credit, have been responsible for taking the knee. Although, as I've made the point in the piece today, you couldn't have a greater example of what taking the knee is supposed to be about than what's happening in Qatar, where that UN report raised questions about racial discrimination, particularly against workers of sub-Saharan African nationalities and South Asian nationalities. And then, of course, issues like Jordan Henderson with the NHS. So a logical follow-on for this should be looking at what's going on in Qatar. But to be fair, and speaking to a lot of people who work in human rights bodies and NGOs around this, I think there's the general discussion is there's so much going on in Qatar at the moment. There's so many issues around this World Cup that to be fair for players, it can feel a little bit vague and abstract. Most people would say, I think you see this a lot, the ultimate response should be to boycott it. I think among human rights bodies, that's not seen as, first of all, I see it as unrealistic, and I also see it as unfair on players. And it's almost like that it would be as if these sort of sports watching interests are taking something else from the game. Because if you think about it, if you're a player and you like, say if it's Ireland, and it's the first World Cup we qualify for since 2002, the first in 20 years, and it happens to be in Qatar. Mm. So suddenly there's this huge pressure to boycott. It's very unfair on a player to have this once in a lifetime, once in a career possibility, and have that suddenly taken away just because of where powers way above their heads have decided the tournament should take place.
Yeah.
So that's putting a lot of pressure on players for, you know, for something that ultimately should be on federations. But at the same time, players do have huge power here. And it's interesting, like the amount of praise that they say the likes of Norway got, rightfully I would say, because at least they've started to broach the issue. But ultimately they're quite, what they did say was quite vague and abstract things. So now that we're getting close to the tournament, it's about articulating what's actually important here. And that's something Southgate said as well. And from speaking to people around, like Paul Nicholas McGee in that piece who works for Fair Square, one of the things that football can really use their power for, how they can actually affect change for this tournament, is that there's two clear issues. Basically, so far with Qatar, there's been no investigation or minimal investigation into worker deaths. And there's been no move towards any sort of compensation to the families of those workers that have died. If footballers can push for those, or federations push for those two things, investigation and compensation, it can generally make a change to thousands of lives. And while it would not mean that this tournament has a good legacy, it can mean the footballers who play in a tournament can actually affect something. As it was put to me yesterday, it can be a potential silver lining to what is obviously a hugely questionable and controversial World Cup. So that is something that I would hope that the players maybe take on board, especially if, as it's going to happen, a lot of them are going to have discussions about it over the next while.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, it's terrible we're at the point of compensation, but that's really where we are, because 10 years have zipped by and tournaments upon us. Miguel Delaney, great stuff. People can check out your...
All going well, I suppose, and I think I'll probably be at the World Cup in December. Now, I know people actually talk about whether the media should go. As an ethical principle, I don't think media should boycott anything. In this case, it is because, again, as human rights groups have put to us, if media don't go, the matches are still going to be put on television, and ultimately a sanitized version of a competition will go out. So whereas people have to go and actually uncover again. And also, it's a huge media event. So like it would be ridiculous for journalists not to go to a huge media event. But I do think it's a World Cup that shouldn't be covered in a normal way. But even I've been thinking about in those terms as well, and I mentioned this in the piece I did today, when we go to Qatar, it's actually very difficult. I think it's probably almost impossible to escape to be untouched by the infrastructure that has led to so many questions that has ultimately been put together by this, by the consequences of this kafala system.
Mm. You say it's bloodstained. I mean, if we're being blunt about it,
That's a really galling thought. Even happening, really. To add to the fact that homosexuality is discriminated against by law in Qatar. I mean, for me, it should be a non-starter that any country with laws like that should get to host what is supposed to be an international event and what is supposed to be a great coming event, what's supposed to bring the world together.
Miguel, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Cheers, Joe.
Cheers. Miguel Delaney there from the London Independent. Independent.co.uk is where you can read his piece today. And football, as ever, on Off the Ball is brought to you by Sky. All the football you love in one place across Sky Sports, BT Sport and Premier Sports.
We got Miguel
Delaney. That'll do.
Keep up to date with the latest WSL action and the biggest interviews.
Him keeping an eye on our games, it just shows how big we're growing.
Subscribe to the Koi Gig podcast stream on the OTB Sports app now.
Now, very happy to say, waiting patiently, and we've kept her waiting, Saoirse Noonan joins us of Shelburne and the Republic of Ireland, and we'll still say Cork as well, I think. Saoirse, thanks so much for joining us. How are you doing?
Very good now, thank you.
Great to have you on the show. There was a time last year when you were scoring goals for Cork City and scoring goals against Kerry for Cork where it seemed every news headline started with you. It was Saoirse Noonan's done X for a while. So the good times have continued. Congratulations, league winners with Shelburne.
Yeah, I suppose it's a bit surreal, still sinking in. As you said, this time last year I was playing with Cork City and the Cork footballers, and yeah, to make such a big move and go to Shelburne now, to be sitting here a year on, after we're in the league and with a cup final to play for, it's really exciting.
Not bad at all. Dramatic final day as well. That bit of drama always helps, I think, and creates an awareness, which is good. So, in a sense, Piemont were in pole position. They were to play Galway. You were behind Piemont. You needed them to slip up. And, of course, you had to beat Wexford as well, who were in third place. So that was no gimme either. And sometimes in life, results go your way and it happens. So Shelburne 3, Wexford 2, which was close enough in the end. Shelburne went 3-0 up. And then Galway 5, Piemont 2 was the crucial result. As you guys were 3-0 up against Wexford, had word filtered through that things were looking good against Galway?
I suppose half-time we kind of got word of it on the pitch as we went in that it was 2-2. So we kind of kept the hope and went out and started the second half with another goal that led to our tally. So, yeah, I think in the last kind of 10, 15 minutes or so, there was words coming in that it was all different scores, really, to be honest. We heard it was 4-3, 3-3, but little did we think it would be 5-2 when we finished up. I think we had a corner at the time and there was a fan behind the goal and he was kind of shouting in, it's 5-2, and then the crowd went mad and we kind of knew then, right, it's in our hands now. So yeah, we just had to try to see out the game, and Wexford kept going till the end, and look, it's football, ain't gonna happen, but we held on to it, so we're delighted now.
Well, when Kylie Murphy makes it 3-2 and scores Wexford second, I'm sure everyone's thinking, ah, for God's sake, we'd be careful here.
Yeah, I think panic stations obviously kind of started to kick in a bit. I suppose we knew we wanted to win the game. We knew we had to win the game if we wanted anything. And when she obviously got that goal, I think there was 6 or 7 minutes left, and they were probably the longest few minutes of our lives. And everyone was probably giving poor Paula a hard time and telling her blow it up. But look, it was an exciting game, and what a day, what a night. Yeah, I'm over the moon.
I can imagine. And Shelburne have had their fair share of runners-up finishes over the last couple of years as well. I know you weren't necessarily part of them, but you could see amongst the crowd and amongst a bunch of the players the excitement and the joy and probably the relief as well. A lot of the pictures at full time were great.
Yeah, definitely. I think for me going to Shells this year, a lot of people kind of said that I was going to a club just to win. But if you really look at it, I probably had won more with Cork City in the last 3 years than Shells had won. They were constantly runners up. So yeah, I was kind of going there to hope that something like this would happen. But I suppose we had a bit of an upset in the middle of the season that we thought we'd given the league away, but we kind of, every game we said to ourselves, we have to keep getting the points on the board, every game will count, keep getting the results, and who knows what can happen. And that's exactly what did happen in the end.
And how far had you fallen off Piemont during the league campaign?
It was just one game really, I think, upset us against them, obviously in their home pitch. We took a battering that day and it really just deflated us a little, but we got back up on the horse next week and we went out and got a solid win. And look, those games there against a load of different teams that we scraped 1-0s, last minute winners, and I suppose those are the days that count. Of course it was one on Saturday night, but without those results, without those last minute winners, we wouldn't have been in the position we were to put it down to the wire with Piemont. Obviously they could have took the title last week as well against DLR, and they got a great result, and then Galway. So it just shows the competitiveness now within the league, which is brilliant.
So three successive runner-up finishes for Shelburne. Saoirse Noonan arrives, they win the league. Are you kind of saying, look, this is the Noonan bounce, this is the Noonan effect in the dressing room, don't want to rub it in, but you're welcome, everyone?
look, there's so much new face, I think, within that squad. And I think even coming in this year, they all said that this is the year that they were going to go for it. And as I said, in the middle of the season, we had a bit of an upset and everyone kind of wrote us off and we kind of kept at it. So yeah, look, I suppose a few of us will have a bit of a skit about that and say we'll take the credit, but no, it's definitely 23-24 players, and you've the young ones as well coming up through the ranks that have definitely pushed us for our spots and made a huge impact throughout the year.
Can I bluntly sum up some aspects of your career? Not all of them, by the way, because right the way through from underage you've been doing it in various codes. You moved to Shelburne in February of this year, big move. You'd had a great time at Cork City. I think you're Cork City's all-time leading goal scorer. You'd won things at Cork City. With the Cork footballers, you made your debut in 2018. I mentioned, you know, the likes of the Heroics against Kerry last year. So that seemed to be going very well. And your manager with Cork GAA said, you know, Saoirse could be the face of Cork GAA for the next 10 years. So that's a, you know, huge compliment as well. but you moved to Shelburne. Vera Powell has really liked what you've been doing, and you've been brought into the senior team and full senior debut this year, which is a huge thing. And during lockdown, you started your own clothing line, and you're still only 22. So pretty much everybody hates you for making them feel inadequate right now. Anything else you want to mention? World peace? No?
No, I think that's about it now.
Pretty amazing. I guess the highlight, or one of the highlights, must be Ireland.
Definitely. I think at the start of the year, I wrote down my goals, my personal and team goals, and that was definitely at the top of the list, and that was probably the main reason that I did move to Shells. And I tell everyone it's not because I thought they were a better club. It's not because I wanted to try just win trophies. It was because I knew if I stayed at Cork City, I was comfortable. I wanted to play GAA if I was here, and it was too accessible for me. So I really wanted to push myself to that next level. And obviously, they had a good few players in their setup, and I wanted to surround myself with people like that I wanted to be like. So, yeah, look, that was the icing on the cake, definitely making my debut against Sweden, and a night I'll never forget.
Yeah. And how difficult a choice was it to park Cork, and I guess to an extent, park Cork GAA as well, Cork City and Cork GAA, and make the move and really focus on Ireland? Because I'm right in saying Vera Powell never said to you, Saoirse, listen, I ain't picking you if you're off playing GAA as well. She never gave you that ultimatum, but you obviously felt maybe it was necessary.
Yeah, no. Vera's been questioned that, and she's always said she was happy with me to do both at the time, and I kind of took it into my own hands. If I wanted to bring my soccer career to the next level, I had to really just focus on one thing.
Okay.
And I think, I suppose, last year in the cup final with Cork City, I kind of knew in my head that if I really wanted to make this next step and get on the Irish team and be consistent in the Irish team, then I would have, that would be my last game with them, and I would try make a move somewhere. Never that I think it would be Shells until Noel King reached out to me. Okay. But yeah, look, it's all been going uphill from there, and I'm really grateful for the position I'm in.
No, it sure has. And there was no way, really, I presume, that you could juggle Shelburne and Cork GAA.
Well, to be honest, I don't know. They probably could have if I really, really tried, but I wouldn't have been able to put in the performances that I would have liked to have, and I wouldn't have been able to give 100% commitment, and it wouldn't have been fair on anyone. And I definitely don't think I would have made my Irish debut if I had done that, because obviously there's a lot of travelling, there's a lot of commitments, and being away with international duty, you're nearly away for 10, 11 days, and you can't be missing 3-4 sessions in inter-county level. So
yeah,
these are just the decisions I had to make.
Yeah, not easy decisions. I mean, a great decision to make. Will I play for Cork or will I try and play for Ireland? I mean, the kind of decisions you want to make in life. Have you noticed a general improvement in your football since you, in effect, went full-time with it? Your touch, your movement, various aspects of the game, or are pretty similar?
Yeah, look, I suppose now that I probably have a bit more free time to train and focus on my own body, and I'm not kind of training every single night, I have more free time, as I'd call it. Even though I'm training by myself, it's kind of under my own time limits. It's how my body feels. It's not, you have to be here at this time, you have to do this run. It's kind of depending on my body that week. So I've definitely felt the benefits of that going into the weekends, whereas I can choose if I want to train a Thursday or Friday, whichever would suit me better that week. So I've definitely seen the benefits of that, recovery-wise and performance-wise. So, yeah, look, I'm getting that little bit older now. I'm still not old, but I'm getting that little bit older. I do have to make sure I don't get injuries and stuff. So,
yeah,
that's definitely been beneficial to me.
Please don't call 22 that little bit older. It's upsetting, upsetting for everybody. Are there different requirements, would you say, fitness-wise, the two sports?
I would say there definitely is. For me, one thing I always struggle with is my fitness, and definitely focusing on one, it's allowed me to kind of take it to the next level. But yeah, look, there are different movements, there are different speeds. So yeah, there definitely is a few, but they definitely as well link in with each other, in turning and being alertness and stuff like that. But there definitely is a small bit of difference and a small bit of similarities.
What is the more physically demanding, did you find?
With the GAA, I suppose it's a lot more contact. You have to be a lot more kind of aware, getting a shoulder inside, aware of being hit, hands all over your body. Like in soccer, you don't get that as much. I think it's more your footwork. Your footwork has to be a lot quicker with controlling the ball, with getting the ball at your feet. So yeah, I suppose like in GA, you're in the ball into your hands straight away. You can hold on to it and then move your feet. Whereas soccer, your feet have to be constantly moving. They're the ones that juggle the ball. They're the ones that make you run. They're the ones that are going to make the pass. So they have to definitely be alert and be there on the day with you, I suppose.
Did I see, I'm half talking off the top of my head, but your brother Owen is a photographer with Sportsfile. He was there to cover your debut for Ireland, I'm right in saying, haven't I? I remember seeing something on Twitter. It was lovely.
Yeah. So he's worked with Sportsfile. He's been at, I think, nearly all my games.
Right.
From underage. He actually got his job with Sportsfile, I think, when I made my under 15 Irish debut around then. So yeah, look, he was there that night too, and I think he was the one that actually took the pictures of me coming onto the pitch and stuff. And then obviously all my family was in the crowd. So those moments are really nice.
That's kind of cool. Sportsfile afterwards are saying, Owen, why are there only pictures of Saoirse here? You need to.
I get enough slagging about that now, so.
And how did you find the step up to Ireland then? Because I know 2016 territory, you were certainly very much on the fringes, and I think there was even a training match in Wales that you might have played with, and Stephanie Roach played, certainly. I was reading that in Wikipedia, but I guess this is your real kind of this year is kind of the first time you've been properly involved and making senior debuts and playing. How have you found the step up from Cork City and Shells and the domestic league to international football?
Yeah, I think my first camp in Iceland, I definitely was a bit taken back. It's so much more faster, and you really have to be at the session. Every session you have to be up there working your backside off, and when you look around, you're looking at Louise Quinn, Katie McCabe, Grace Maloney, Denise O'Sullivan, all these players that are really established within the WSL in America. So it definitely is the next level, and it's the level you want to be at. But when you are training with them and you're getting compliments from them, it definitely makes you want to go to that next level, and it is inspiring playing with them and seeing how technically gifted they are, how hard they work every session, and just the graft they put in. And I suppose everyone wants to be like them, and even playing with them now, I still look up to them as players, and just they're inspiring seeing what they're doing week in, week out. And again, Leanne Kiernan, winning player of the month this month, she's just an inspiration, and I grew up playing with her, and I kind of look at her and say, well, I grew up at the same age as her. She played with Shelburne. She's now gone across the water. So there's opportunities, and it's exciting times ahead.
Yeah. Has there been any interest from England in you?
Right now the focus is on the cup final.
I'm getting you in trouble. Cup final. Cup final. <Sorry. laughs> What about life off the pitch then? Big move up to Dublin. I mentioned at the top, I hadn't realised this, I was just reading today that you started your own clothing line. So what are your interests, or what's life away from the football?
Yeah, so I suppose lockdown, obviously I had a lot of time to myself, and it was always something I wanted to do. So I set up my own company, Freedom, and yeah, it's been going good. Obviously, it's been a quite hectic few months on the pitch, as well as off the pitch, and I'm in my final year of college in marketing, so I'm just trying to get my hands in a bit of everything. But yeah, look, it's brilliant. It's Freedom Official Clothing if anyone wants to check it out. And yeah, look, I'm just I suppose living day to day and just enjoying it and trying out new things and hoping for the best.
Yeah, amazing. Sorry, I didn't realise you're studying marketing as well, so you've got education taking up plenty of your time too.
Yeah, final year now, so okay. The next couple of weeks are a bit intense, but it'll all be worth it once I have my degree, hopefully at the end of next year.
Oh, brilliant. Where are you doing that, Saoirse?
MTU.
Okay. So is the fashion world one that you would like to make full-time career down the line, more than just a hobby? I mean, if you've set up a company, that speaks of a certain seriousness, to say the least. Is that kind of the absolute dream?
Yeah, I think off the pitch, definitely. It definitely is the dream. I think I've always wanted to have something kind of that I'd be known for away from the football pitch, because like even though women's sport is increasing and I suppose it's getting more coverage, it's still not there, and you can't rely on it for a lifetime career. And I always wanted to just have that one thing that I could say, I'm not just a footballer, I also I also have this. So yeah, look, that's definitely something that I want to progress on off the pitch, and hopefully next couple of years I can get my hands right in there and really move it up the ladder.
Yeah, no, it's great. And I'd say it takes some of the pressure out of sport in some respects as well, that it's not all that you are and all that you're thinking about. And we spoke to Nifai recently, who's doing just fine in the world of football and captaining Liverpool, but she has her pharmacology studies behind her, and you know, she says it's a lovely safety net.
Yeah, definitely. I think we all want that safety net. It just takes the pressure off that little bit. People are being signed and unsigned, I suppose, yearly nearly, so you can't always rely on it. And again, look, unfortunately, people get injuries and these things happen, but it is nice to have that thing behind you that you enjoy away from the pitch. And I definitely love doing it, so hopefully.
Brilliant. Well, listen, that sounds great. So, I don't know, 10 years' time, we'll have a chat. You want business empire, several All-Irelands with Cork, World Cup with Ireland, and plenty more besides, I guess. That's the dream. You gotta
fingers
go for
crossed,
it, though.
Fingers crossed.
Are you wearing the gear now?
Yeah, this is one of the jumpers. So okay. This is just the pink one. Then we have white and black and sweaters and stuff as well. So, yeah.
Okay, brilliant. You didn't insist, by the way, on like a marketing campaign. You came on to talk about Shelburne, I should say. This isn't Saoirse shamelessly
plugging.
Yeah. Well done, congrats. League winning season and continued success with Ireland. Obviously very exciting times at the moment with Ireland. I'd say that's a pretty cool camp to be a part of right now. So best of luck, and we'll talk to you again soon, I'm sure. Saoirse Noonan, thanks a mil.
Thank you very much for your time.